And good morning to Gary in Chicago.
And good evening. No, you've confused me already.
How
It's good evening to Gary in Chicago. Good morning to Jonathan in Perth.
you? That's right. I hope you're enjoying the cool, balmy Chicago winter.
I'm gathering that by the time it gets to the lowest temperature tonight, we'll have something like 110, 130 degrees difference between where you are and where I am.
Well, we would have yesterday. Yeah, it's comparatively mild right at the moment, but it was fairly hot here in sunny pre-summery Perth. It's not even summer yet, and we were at 40.1 degrees, I think, yesterday, or 104, I think. So, we're lining up for a nice hot summer.
Well, it sounds like something I don't envy you. We're heading up for a nice cold winter, but people in Chicago, winters are never as cold in Chicago as people think they are. Although those of us in Chicago alternately say it's really a nice climate, but if we're in a place that's colder, we'll say no, we get really miserably cold in Chicago and you couldn't survive there.
Well, I actually, as you know, I lived in San Francisco, well, Oakland, for a year, and I thought they had close to the ideal climate. I really did. I loved it. Summers weren't too hot, winters weren't too cold, whereas, obviously where you are, it gets pretty damn cold. And here it can be quite uncomfortably hot for a large chunk of the year. What I always find interesting is how people react to your climate from abroad. If I talk to someone from the UK, for example, they're all, "Oh, you mean there's like sun and it's like bright and you can go like go outside?" And you're going like, "Yeah, yes, we have sun all the time." Yeah, I've been, it's been known to go like 3 months without a cloud, kind of thing.
That's astonishing.
Yeah, so I think we were down to what 1% humidity yesterday.
My God.
So it's like,
Well,
ah.
it's.
So in these dry, arid hours, guess what I did this morning?
What did you do this morning?
I read my own blog. Isn't that narcissistic? I went back. I'll tell you why I was doing it. It was not totally narcissistic, though. It was, yeah, semi-narcissistic. I was just going back to prod my own recollection of the year that we've been through. I mean, it's almost the end of the year, and I suddenly thought, well, how's it been? And in amongst all my own sort of meanderings and complaining and everything, there's been a lot going on. We've had a big year, really, as we move towards the end of it.
Big in what sense? Just in terms of volume of books or
Well,
quality of work or.
I think, I mean, honestly, everything. First of all, I think the volume part goes without saying. There is always now. In fact, it is almost at the stage where I feel like I should go back to my year's best and cut it out of the introduction now. There's such a torrent of stuff all the time that you almost might as well not comment on it. There are more short stories. I mean, there's like thousands and thousands and thousands of short stories. And there are thousands of books. And there's always now going to always be a very significant chunk of those books that you'll never ever look at because it's just physically impossible. However, I guess the reason I say it's a big year, well, Locus sort of had a big year in the sense that who we both work for, that they had a successful year so far, and have been getting through, have now got through the first year, fully under the editorship of Liza Trombi, and that's a big thing, showing the ongoing vitality of that.
True.
You've had Bearings Out, which is a big thing, your second big collection of review essays from Beckom, and that's a big deal. You were a world fantasy judge. That was a big thing.
You're a world fantasy winner, which is a big thing.
And very much, and as I had to sort of somewhat hubristically acknowledge, and won several other awards during the year too. So I won the Locus Award, I won the Aurealis Award.
How many? Well, and this is all for the previous year's work. And you've actually, if I'm not mistaken, have more books out this year than possibly in any single year so far.
Yes, that's true.
In
I've had
2011, 2010.
yes, I've had 11, 11
11
books.
books.
Yes, so that I've worked on. Yes, five anthologies and six short story collections, I think, and a magazine issue that I guest edited. So I think that's it. So that was really big. I've had more work out. I've had more feedback. It's been more successful. So all that kind of stuff is big. And then when I look around, I mean, in the background, sort of unbeknownst to you, dear listener, though it will come to your attention soon, we've also been working quietly and confidentially on the beginnings of the Locus recommended reading list. And that sort of has begun to show that there have been some very, very good books published during the year. you know, whatever passing flaws any individual work may or may not have, you know, there have been a good handful of strong, strong science fiction novels and fantasy novels and stories and everything. It has basically been a heck of a year.
And quality-wise, is it a heck of a year? I mean, the volume of stuff out is unflagging. I remember, I think a year or so ago, I mean, the other thing I'm looking at, we're looking at the Locus recommended reading list. We're also looking at, first fantasy book nominees for the Crawford Award.
You bet.
And actually, that's, I would say what I'm seeing there is a short but strong list, which is unusual. I mean, it's not uncommon to have, and we're talking a very narrow window here of new writers, essentially.
Yeah.
But it could be a book, could be a collection of short stories or a novel, but it's a first book. And we came up with maybe a dozen or so, maybe 15 or 20 tops reasonable titles, of which there are five or six that are really pretty strong, which is a very good proportion.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that's very hard for me to figure out, and it's one of the things that does happen in the Locus recommended reading list, because the debates that seem to go on about this really have more to do with the Locus not recommended list.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in other words, the question is which books and how many of them do you think are not really worth thinking about or not worth recommending a year later? And I think one of the things about the recommended reading list that probably escapes people's attention is that this is a list which appears in Locus magazine in February. Other end-of-the-year recommended lists are starting to appear already. PW is putting out a recommended list and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And these are lists that are, by and large, coming out 6 months to a year after the book itself.
Yes.
So what you're really saying is you're recommending, you know, months or years after this book has appeared, is it going to be worth looking at? In other words, a book I might recommend this week, I'd say it looks good now, but you know, after 20 more books come out, it doesn't look so good.
Well, I've varied over time about how I think you should interpret something like the recommended reading list.
Mm-hmm.
I think now I've come to a point of view that I see it as being a quick thumbnail sketch of the year as it was, as we look back over our shoulder in the car driving into the year that we're going into. Because, I mean, the one thing we never do, and I can't imagine having the time or the ability to do it, is to go and, say, pull up a 10 years ago recommended reading list and say, okay, what if that was worth recommending? And if we still have all the original working papers, which I'm sure we don't, what did we overlook that in retrospect we feel we should have seen? Now, I think we've always done pretty well at not overlooking much at all, frankly. And the lists tend to be quite comprehensive. But there's always stuff I'm sure you'd look at it and go, well, I have no idea why we recommended that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though I'm sure it made sense at the time. I wish I could lay my hands on, I don't have them here, like a really old recommended reading list, one that none of us worked on at all, because then I would feel comfortable sort of talking about it, and we wouldn't have to sit there and go, I don't really want to say anything about that one. But, I mean, if you were to pull up, say, a 1985 recommended reading list or something, and then we could talk about it a little and say, well, I mean, how much of that stuff proved to be worthy of recommendation?
Mm-hmm. Well, the same thing could be true of the Nebula Awards or the Hugo Awards or the Nobel Prizes. I mean, it's one of the favorite games that people play with Nobel Prizes is pointing out that, you know, the James Joyce and Marcel Proust never got one, but Maurice Maeterlinck did. So that kind of thing, and Pulitzer Prizes are the same way. You look at the list of Pulitzer Prizes going back before about 1970, and I would guess that most people have not even heard of most of those books.
Oh, sure.
And sometimes a book, and there are biases that work with these books. I mean, Neuromancer, as I recall, did not win the Locus Award.
Yeah.
But I think it did win everything else that year.
Yeah.
And what were they thinking, is the first question that comes to mind.
That's true. Actually, okay, I've got one for you. This falls into a dead spot for me. When the 2000 recommended reading list came out, I was not. I don't believe I was working for the magazine. It was one of that brief period in between.
Mm-hmm.
Though Charles may have come out the following year, but I think this year I wasn't involved. It was before Liza or a number of the current staff joined. You were involved. Now, I'm just going to run down a couple of the science fiction books and tell me, now that it's nearly 11 years later, Did they stand up? Genesis by Paul Anderson?
Probably not.
Look to Windward by Ian Banks? Probably.
Yeah, probably.
Candle by John Barnes?
I don't think so. I read that one, and that seemed very much a book of its time, for some reason.
Manifold Space by Steve Baxter?
If you were going to list the major works of Steve Baxter, looking back on his career, I don't think that would be one of them. Because first of all, it's part of a trilogy. It's part of a thematic trilogy. So it goes back to the problem we've talked about before. When you've got a book which is part of a series, and the series itself is significant.
Exactly. Okay. Eater by Greg Benford.
Actually, no.
I would have to say no as well. I mean, I'm a Greg Benford fan, and I could name a handful of his books that will stand the test of time in the field.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that one's not one of them. The Memory of Fire by George Foy.
I've not read that. I don't even know what that is, actually.
Me either. Hunted by James Allen Gardner.
I haven't read that, but strikes me as something that I've...
So far, we're on one book out of the list that we reckon... Crescent City Rhapsody by Kathy Goonan.
I think that's an important series, and I think that this is a kind of personal quest of mine, but I think Kathy Goonan is one of the more underrated writers of the last 15 or so years, and that whole series, I think, is enormously important. We talked about that a little bit last week, when women writers would come in and sort of reinvent a trope, and I think she completely reinvented the nanotech trope with those novels.
And did it brilliantly, just brilliantly.
Absolutely.
So from that perspective, you've got to sit there and go, well, okay, I would, but the funny thing is, I don't even know if it's in print. I'd have to go and look. This is something else we'll touch on maybe later on, the whole issue of being in print and out of print.
Right.
But I don't know if it's in print. The Coming by Joe Haldeman. A minor late Joe Haldeman book?
I would say this. If you're looking at the understanding the best of Joe Haldeman, which is something you and I should talk about, it may not be on that. I think it's an important book in the context of his work. Compared to some of the other things that he's done, it's not one of the major works.
Midnight Robber by Nahlo Hopkins.
Yes, I would include that.
Me too. I agree.
I think there are all kinds of reasons that the thing when we're mentioning the titles and the three that are jumping out at me when you mention the Kathy Goonan and the Ian Banks and now the Nahlo Hopkinson is that those are the ones where you mention them and I'm surprised that's 10 years ago.
Yeah, I know.
Because they still seem very current books, and maybe that's a way of telling if a book still seems alive is 10 years later. You say, was that really 10 years ago?
I know. See, some of this is going to – and I think that's true. And I think it's actually going to feed back to a point that I'm going to make in a second. Okay. We've got the third of the Probability books by Nancy Kress, Probability Moon.
I think that's, again, an important series.
But I don't know it's an important book. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if the book by itself would necessarily be regarded as a classic at this point.
The Telling by Le Guin?
I don't think – I'm not crazy about The Telling. It's a Le Guin title, and Le Guin is the most canonical living writer we had. I would put that in something of the same category as – even though it's actually getting more into the fantasy area.
Yeah.
It's something of the same area of Joe Haldeman's The Coming. I don't think it's one of the great Le Guin books. But then you're comparing it to some phenomenally great books when you say that.
Absolutely true. And I think there's some important points to come out of this. Actually, I think this is kind of interesting to do. Ken MacLeod's The Sky Road, which is part of his first, the fall trilogy or whatever it is.
Well, and that strikes me as being, I would put that in a weird way in the same category as the Nahlo Hopkinson book, in that here's a very important writer who sort of, it was Nahlo's second book. This was one of, I think, maybe his second book in the States anyway.
Yeah.
And so it certainly represented the advent of an important new writer doing important new things.
Yeah. I think that's true. Now, then you've got Colony Fleet by Susan R. Matthews.
I have no idea what that is. I should know. But
shame, Gary, shame. That's terrible. We've certainly reviewed it and discussed it. Anyway, Shrine of Stars by Paul McCauley, which is one of the Confluence series.
The Confluence series, again, is a very important series. I don't know why that has not gotten as much attention as it has. It's this was the series he did, as I recall, just before he started writing thrillers. And it seems to me what was happening 10 years ago, this was a very significant far future series that may not have been as successful as it could. And shortly after that, he was doing things like White Devils. So one of the things that I can see already happening in 2000 is Greg Binford's Eater is a kind of international high-tech spy thriller, you know, with a hard science fiction concept at the center of it. Macaulay's book is really, I think, one of his last books before he went off in that direction as well.
Yes, and then it happily came back, but yes.
And came back, yes.
Okay, The Miocene Arrow by Sean McMullen.
I can't comment on it.
Tell you what I'll do. Just to hurry things along, I'm going to run through and just sort of take a second to shout out if any of them sound as though they really stand out, because there's just a handful left. There's Distance Haze by Jamal Nasser. There's Outlet Lower School by Rebecca Orr. There's Marrow by Robert Reed.
An important book. I think the Robert Reed thing strikes me as being, partly it's a book we've been waiting for Robert Reed to do to some extent. And it's a hugely important concept. And again, it hasn't had the legs of that you would expect it to have.
That's something else I want to come back to, maybe if we remember later in the podcast. The Problem of Robert Reed. We'll come back to it, okay?
Yes, that is it.
Okay, Ventus by Carl Schrader.
Not a major work, but again, there's a major writer coming into the field.
True. The Jazz by Melissa Scott.
Don't know it.
Fountains of Youth by Brian Stableford.
I have a fondness for that series by Brian Stableford. I think it really is one of the most thoughtful.
Me too.
It's very slow moving in some ways. It's almost stately in the way it's conceived. But I think it's one of the most thoughtful treatments of immortality ever written in science fiction, and should have gotten a great deal more attention than it did. It thinks through the kind of historical memory that would be involved in somebody, you know, living extended lifespans. There's some absolutely beautiful writing in it, and it seems to me that might very well be his best. That the series might be his best single work. One of the problems with Brian Stableford, there's another problem, is that there is so much material in so many different genres and so many different subgenres that it gets lost in the blur. But this is one, I think, really solid series of
novels.
I agree.
And I actually think that's the best book of the set as well, actually.
I think that is too, yes.
Zeitgeist by Bruce Sterling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because Zeitgeist was one of the first novels, and I think to some extent, watching the parallel careers of Sterling and Gibson has been, especially with the most recent series, you know, ending with Zero History, has been credited widely with having more or less invented the concept of writing contemporary science fiction, in the sense that he's writing about the contemporary world, but it's so science fictional that you don't notice the difference. And one of the first books I remember reading that actually did that was Zeitgeist.
Yes, I agree. Fresco by Sherry Tepper. Probably the last book before her big gap in her writing.
Yeah. Sherry Tepper's another problem. there are some very powerful. I don't know that I would consider this one of the major ones, but it's a good novel.
Yeah.
The problem with Sherry Tepper after a while is that you get the point. I mean, you've kind of got the message.
Yeah.
I only met her once, and I talked to her about this, and she's well aware of the fact, at that point, she was well aware of the fact that she had these, you know, passionate ecological, academics used to call her an eco-feminist, which is a wonderful term. Yep. But that's essentially, and she believed in that, and the messages sometimes hit you over the head, and she said she can't help but do that, because the message is what she wants. You know, she's writing the novel for a very didactic purpose, and her novel's going to look, and her argument was she can't not do that.
Yeah.
She does it more or less well in all of her novels. The thing about Sherry Tepper is I would say if you took any one of those novels from that period, Six Moon Dance and that sort of thing, and if that was the only Sherry Tepper you'd ever read, you'd think it's very powerful.
Probably so.
If you read a bunch of her novels in succession, you begin to feel a little bit browbeaten.
I found it so. I mean, I loved Grass, and I loved some of her earlier books, which were less didactic. But then I found that, much as you suggest, I'd kind of got the idea, and I didn't feel driven to revisit that reading experience. The last book on the science fiction list, In Green's Jungles by Gene Wolfe.
Oh, I'm sorry, what was the title again?
In Green's Jungles. It's the second of the Book of the Short Sun.
Yeah, the fifth of the whole 12-volume series. It's again a major part. It's part of a gigantic major work that can't be ignored. That certainly should have been on the list.
And then just out of the first novels thing, because we're talking about science fiction, I'll just drop in three quick ones, which were the science fiction recommend first novels for that year: Serious Storm by David Herder, which was not, I think, a major work. Mars Crossing by Jeffrey Landis, which is his only novel, surprisingly.
Really?
Yeah, apparently. I think so. That surprises the heck out of me.
That surprises me, yeah.
I reviewed that for Locus, and I remember it quite fondly, so I'm surprised. Revelation Space by Al Reynolds, who's gone on to become quite a big name.
Well, that's a hugely important novel in many ways in terms of the whole new space opera idea.
Yes, and Salt by Adam Roberts.
Which hasn't held up as well. I was fascinated by the concept, and then I wasn't.
And can I tell you, here's my observation, right, seriously, about that list. I actually think it's as good a list as we've put together in some ways, because I think it represents the year. You know, you have some works which were worthwhile at the time but don't stand the test of time, some which presage the future in the sense that so-and-so is going to become a much more important writer than they are here, but already of interest. And there's that smattering of books that actually prove to be the major ones. What's kind of interesting then is to zip over as well and have a look at what made the major awards ballots at the time.
Uh-huh.
Because if you go to the Nebulas, if you remember at that time, they had that really screwy eligibility.
Oh, that was a bizarre thing where you had two and a half year old novels on the list.
So even though you had that, of the six novels up for the Nebula that year, two were from the preceding year, Darwin's Radio by Greg Bear and Civil Campaign by Lois Bujold. So of our group, in fact, two, Crescent City Rhapsody and Midnight Robber, were actually on our list. And the other, which is Jack McDevitt's Infinity Beach, didn't actually make our list. I don't think there's a year distortion. Then for the Hugos, I don't have the actual full nominations, but the Telling by Le Guin won. No, the Telling by Le Guin won the... Oh, that's right. Sorry, that's the Locus Awards. The Telling by Le Guin won the Locus Awards, and Mars Crossing won the Best First Novel. And you would have thought, logically, looking back, Revelation Space would have been the book, but this is what happens. And in fact, only two of our science fiction novels made the Hugo ballot, in Midnight Robber and The Sky Road.
Do you think that maybe part of what this suggests is that the Hugo voting tends to be a bit more conservative than what the Locus recommended reading list is? Because what we're looking for in the reading list is we're keeping our eye out for new things.
Yeah.
We're not necessarily valuing and keeping in mind that in 2000 probably Charles had a much heavier thumb on the list than he did in recent years, or that we obviously he's not there this year. But for example, you mentioned something like McDevitt's in Infinity Beach, and McDevitt is a very enjoyable writer, and he's very accessible. He's frequently popular among Hugo voters, I would think.
Yeah.
Whereas something like Al Reynolds, coming up with a huge, complex novel that he did, that a lot of people would look at and say, what is this? And then once he's established that sort of voice and that sort of style, it becomes more acceptable. So it could very well be that Hugos are simply... I think there is, without demeaning any particular group of Hugo voters, since it is a popular vote, there's a comfort level, there's a comfort zone that would tend to reward beloved writers accessible writers.
There is. I mean, I guess in the case of Al Reynolds, you have to allow that I forget what time of year Revelation Space came out, right? But it did come out in the UK first.
Ah.
See? It didn't come out till the following year, I think, in the States. So the reason I'm going to guess it didn't perform better at the Hugos is because it hadn't come out, and you know, it hadn't come out in the US, and it was a first novel, so it wasn't well known, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think those are the sorts of reasons rather than anything else. And it was only sort of later on that things sort of turned around a bit in that area. But I mean, it does mean that whatever list we come up with this year And that's completely behind the curtain, and I don't want to get to it, and I know you don't either. I think it'll be the same thing. I think it'll be that small smattering of really important books that we will look at, you know, in 2020 and say, of course, you know, we were going to look at that. There will be a batch of books we look at and go, well, I mean, they're solid books from their authors, and they were worthwhile, and they're part of a good year. Another batch will go and say, I don't really remember that. I think that's inevitable.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it probably would be even more true if we got into novellas and short stories and and that sort of thing. I mean, it's very hard. It takes a really powerful short story to be remembered 10 years later.
Yes.
But the other problem, which is one which is worth keeping in mind when we come up with lists like this, is that disjuncture between British and American editions of books. I mean, one of the books I'm reading right now for review, it's interesting because it's a book that certainly I think should be looked at next year, is Graham Joyce's The Silent Land.
Yeah.
Which is, I think it's already out in the UK, and it I is. Think it's a March book in the United States. And so which year is it? If it comes out in the UK in late 2010 and becomes visible only to American readers sometime in 2011, it's obviously put itself in some senses at a disadvantage for, let's say, the World Fantasy Award judges will see it. And it is a fantasy novel, I suppose.
Yeah. I think there's still a rolling year of eligibility. I mean, it'll get considered for the Locus Awards, and we'll talk about it. The Nebulas are, I think, back on a straight calendar year basis, though I'm not expert enough to be sure of that. And I'm fairly sure, I feel quite confident that the rolling eligibility thing is in place for the Hugos. So I think there's that chance if the Hugo voters take to it. I do think the Hugo voters have enough to be getting on with, frankly. There are enough science fiction novels, enough fantasy novels to be filling a ballot very credibly. So yeah.
Well, that's the other thing. It seems to me it feels like it's been a strong year.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of stuff that they haven't gotten to that I wanted to get to. But every time we hear that that things are drying up, and you come up with another year's worth of novels that are as good as they were 5 or 10 years ago. I mean, when you were reading that list, without giving away anything that's likely to show up on the recommended reading list this year, I think I think this year's list is comparable in terms of quality and variety to what that one was 10 years ago.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not looking at the list. I'm literally looking at a shelf. I have a 2010 shelf behind my desk, and right off the top of my head, I mean, just looking, I can see the Ian Banks novel, Surface Tension.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's things like Hani Ryan Yemi's novel and the latest Alice Reynolds novel and Connie Willis's double and the Greg Egan novel, which is a good one, the Ian MacDonald. There's a batch of really strong novels. Whether we're going to particularly remember every single one of them in 10 years, I don't know. I was just looking at, I'm trying to see if I remember the name of the book. I read a recommendation. In fact, I read Adrian Martini's review in advance for a book called How to Live in a Science Fictional World, I think it's called.
I've heard of it.
By somebody you. And I did one of the things, actually, this is something which I was going to touch on as well, so it's not completely irrelevant for us to have this. It's good. I did the ebook thing. I fired up my Kindle, right?
Mm-hmm.
As I never did before because I didn't have a Kindle. And I downloaded the first 3 chapters of it in a sampler. I mean, one of the things Charles would do when he wasn't sure whether a book was recommendable is he would actually pull up a copy, because he'd have them sitting around the house, look at the cover and go, that looks good or not, and read the flap copy and maybe the first, chapter or two. Well, I read the first two chapters of How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe by Charles Yu, and it's good. It's a really interesting looking book. I have to I'm probably going to have to not only download the damn thing to finish reading it, but probably buy it so I have a copy of it. So there's always something else around the corner.
Well, that's the thing that fascinates me, are the number of things, because of the ways in which a novel like that, which is essentially, as far as I can tell, marketed completely as a mainstream novel.
Mm-hmm.
How do they come to our attention? Because one of the things that happens, not only with Locus, I've talked to other review venues as well, is that occasionally a mainstream book will come out, which is very interesting, or which may be of associational interest, and they simply aren't going to send it to us. Because it's because they're not interested in us, frankly. And in some cases where you get a writer who's who wants us to pay attention to his work, whether it's mainstream or not, you get a Jonathan Lethem or a Michael Chabon, we see that. Other than that, sometimes we have to go out and find these books.
Yes.
You know, Richard Powers, for example, not the artist, but the American novelist who's been writing versions of science fiction novels at least since Galatea 2.0 several years ago. Those things never get sent to us for review.
No.
But they're interesting books. Some of them are interesting. There was one this past – no, it was a year before last, I guess, called Sunshine. And to some extent, between the small presses and the small literary presses and the mainstream publishers, there's a lot of science fiction that's out there that doesn't come to our attention, in the same way that science fiction books that we love and adore don't come to the attention of the mainstream press. And this is a good thing and a bad thing at the same time. It's a good thing in that these barriers we've been trying to break down for decades are actually breaking down. But the barriers are still there as far as the marketing people are concerned.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting books that I'm reading, I just finished for what will be the January column, is Joe Walden's, among others.
Yes.
Which is it's three things at once. It's a wonderful, loving memoir of reading science fiction as a teenager in England in the late 70s. It's a fantasy novel about witches, and but it may be a ma- and thirdly, it's a mainstream novel about coming of age. It ideally would reach all of those audiences. You know, whether Tor can do that with it, or I don't know. I know that's something that that they're concerned about, but it's a beautifully written book.
It would be,
It's one of these questions. If this were not Joe Walton, if it was somebody we'd never heard of, if somebody who had sold this to Random House, and it were marketed pretty much in the way How to Live in the Science Fictional Universe is marketed, would we ever even see it unless we found it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm the books that perplex. It's one of the kind of books that perplexes me more because, you know, I understand how The Road, right, Cormac McCarthy's book, even though it's science fiction, isn't marketed as science fiction, isn't considered as science fiction, all that kind of thing. I completely understand it. But, I mean, this year, for example, we've got two books that come immediately to mind, Go Mutants by Larry Doyle, which has had some fantastic reviews. I've not read it, but had some great reviews. And this Charles Yu book, which is about a time machine repairman in an alternate universe. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not, like, just a little bit science fiction. This is a guy who writes, who, you know, who read Asimov as a kid, and it's science fiction, and
it's flat out science fiction.
But it's almost as though the publishers either don't know how to communicate to a science fiction readership, or they simply just don't care. They don't even see it as being science fiction. They're mainstream publishers. These are mainstream books that has other stuff in it, you know. And it's now all internalized, and they're just going to put them out, and it falls, as far as they're concerned, at least outside our dialogue.
I'd love to talk to somebody who's actually involved in marketing with us and find once we get them really drunk, at least.
Yeah.
And find out if – because one of the things I've suspected, and I've suspected this for years now, is that there's a sense that the science fictional market might be marginal enough that there's a sense you can do more damage to a book by appealing to science fiction readers than not. In other words, that any kind of science fictional label will look like it's poison to the book. I've almost convinced myself that the last two Margaret Atwood novels, and every time Margaret Atwood, this is only the last two of her novels. This is not going back to The Handmaid's Tale. It's Oryx and Crake and the sequel to Oryx and Crake, The Flood. Was it Flood? Was that something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
Year of the Flood.
Yeah.
Both of those novels coincided with Atwood giving interviews in which she pointedly pointed out how she wasn't a science fiction writer. Even though in other times, when she's not got a book coming out, she's very sympathetic and very supportive of science fiction.
Yes, yes.
And that began to look to me like, well, is this Atwood protecting the Margaret Atwood market? Is she afraid that she will actually lose sales if her readers think she's written a science fiction book? But as long as it isn't labeled as such, they'll read it happily. Yeah. I don't know.
I'm a little bit skeptical that that's true. I think it's something else. I mean,
I hope it's not true.
I read a throwaway comment from somebody talking about ebooks, and what they basically said was that all, no, what was it about? Yeah, ebook readers. That all of the significant book sales, you know, number of sales, are sold to casual readers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you like, the broader the appeal to the casual reader, the better, because the likelihood is that a science fiction reader will pick up How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe, or might pick up Go Mutants, or will pick up, you know, whatever else. Whereas, your casual reader may say, well, I don't particularly like that sci-fi stuff, maybe. Or that's just a little bit outside my comfort zone, or whatever the way that, you know, you might choose to phrase it. So I think it's more just simply a matter of focusing what you're doing, rather than attempting to say that sort of like dirty and unclean. You know, if you've got something that's not unambiguously science fiction. I mean, if you've got an Al Reynolds book, then the core of your audience is the science fiction readership, and that's where you're going to go, and you'll hope to pick up all the casual science fiction readers as well. But for everybody else, it's like, maybe that's not such the best idea to get your book read widely.
Well, and you've got somebody who, and Art Atwood is an exceptional case, because she is a best-selling writer. She has, you know, a huge readership on her own, and she doesn't want to alienate that readership. But when you look at other books like Go Mutants, and I did get an advance copy of that, it seemed to me to be very much marketed as a kind of wildly comic novel, which riffs on science fiction movies of the 50s and riffs on conventions from science fiction. I've seen other books do that as well. I mean, to some extent, to go back to The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, to Michael Chabon's novel, which first kind of moved.
Yep.
It's about the comic book world. There was a David Schwartz novel called Superpowers last year, which is a guy who's actually one. He's a genre reader and writer and so forth. But again, the marketing of the book was, this is kind of the same. It's ancillary science fiction in the sense that it deals with superheroes, it deals with comic books, it deals with science fiction iconography from the 50s. That's stopping short of saying it's actually science fiction.
Yeah, it is.
I think there's huge marketing appeal in the sort of furniture that goes along with science fiction.
Yeah.
There was a novel, I can't remember who wrote it, there was a novel a few years ago, marketed as a mainstream novel, about Godzilla.
Yes.
And was that called Gojira? It might
yes,
have
it was. By Mark somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And there's a huge marketing potential in sort of the pop culture aspect of science fiction.
Yes.
What I think of as the iconography, the nostalgia aspect of it.
And that's very much where How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe is marketed.
Mm-hmm.
In that pop culture space.
Right. And for that matter, Juno Diaz, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, which was, and here's a guy who loves science fiction. He was at ReaderCon. He was delightful. He loves to write science fiction, but he's made it as a mainstream literary writer. And the fact that book is about a science fiction fan lends to its pathos to some extent.
Sure.
But there's also the entire, sort of historical family stuff in it, which makes it go. But the nostalgia for science fiction, the love of science fiction in that book is really palpable. And he knows what he's talking about. Yeah. He knows the difference between the Grey Lensman and the Forever War, for example. So there is this sense of there's a subcategory of writers who have sort of made it in the mainstream, who really like and appreciate genre work and are really fascinated by it. I mean, Brian Evanson is another one. Mm-hmm, we mentioned Chabon. We mentioned Lethem. And the writers themselves, most of whom I've talked to about this, are absolutely thrilled to be part of this sort of science fiction fantasy community. But at the same time, the worlds in which they live still think they're a little bit weird for it. Brian Evanson's done two B.K. Evanson novels now that are – one is based on an Aliens versus Predators movie, and the other one's based on some role-playing game, I think.
Yep.
So he's building two careers at two different extremes. One, he's writing, he's building three careers. One is a purely mainstream writer with the open curtain and that sort of thing. Secondly, really is a horror writer, because he was on the World Fantasy Ballot this year for Fugue State, and his story, his novel, Last Days, is just absolutely brutal. And thirdly, there's this flat-out pop culture, I'm going to do novelizations of games and movies aspect. Now he may. I think that's a hugely encouraging kind of move that a writer can feel comfortable in all three of those areas and have fun writing in all those areas.
Yes. Well, does it actually to tilt a really old windmill, right? Given that we're talking a guy like that who's been nominated for the awards that he's been nominated for and everything else, are we wrong to overlook a Dead Space novel by Brian Evanson?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I mean, one of the questions that we've come up with is, one of the running jokes which you and I may have mentioned before was some idea that I forgot who it was came up with the idea. Let's get Gene Wolfe to write a Star Wars novel.
That was my one, yeah.
That was yours, okay. But and if he did, would we ignore it because it was a Star Wars novel?
No.
I have been, I'm thinking of Karen. Who's the writing? There's a good British novelist who started writing Star Wars novels.
Karen Miller?
I'm blank. I can't think of the name right now.
I don't know.
I'll think of it before the conversation's over. But again, it was something that I'd reviewed a couple of her novels, and then I got sent, not by Locus but by the publisher, a couple of Star Wars novels, and I thought, well, that's not Karen Travis.
Yeah.
Karen Travis, that's who I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
And she wrote a couple of her first novel was terrific. She's a very promising writer. And I think her third and fourth and maybe fifth novels were Star Wars novels, which are certainly making more money for her. I think it probably put her on the Times bestseller list. And I didn't read them. And I didn't read them, frankly, out of sheer bias, because I was thinking, well, I only get so many books to review a month. And then what happens if I start reviewing Star Wars novels? And then I talked to a friend who said, no, she's really writing good novels, you know, using the Star Trek iconography, using the characters, using the settings and so forth. There's nothing inherently involved in the Star Trek universe or the Star Wars universe or the World of Warcraft universe that prevents you writing a good novel. I think we tend not to look at them out of knee-jerk reactions.
Well, knee-jerk reactions and time. I mean, I was just thinking as well, I mean, would we review every Sean Stewart novel? I mean, he hasn't written one in 6 or 7 years, but would we?
Good question. I mean,
because we didn't review his Yoda novel, and we haven't reviewed the what do you call kind of game ones that he's done, you know, the sort of virtual reality gaming-y kind of ones, Kathy's book, those things, I Heart Bees, right. That stuff.
We haven't, I love Bees, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think part of the reason I can't tell you why we or anybody else does or doesn't review this, because I'm not the reviews editor, but part of it is there is this sense of what I sometimes come to think of as auxiliary novels. This is one of the things that, in other words, novels that are written as part of somebody else's conception, or novels that are written within the framework of some Bible that people are given. I don't know if they still do this, but I know years ago, if you were writing a Star Trek novel or stories, you were given a list of rules you could not violate.
Yeah.
You know, you could not suddenly reveal that that Spock was gay, for example. And I don't know if that's still going on or not. It seems to me that there are very good writers, and not only now, but there have always been very good writers who have done these things. I mean, Elizabeth Hand has done movie novelizations.
Sure, sure.
Joe Haldeman, the Star Trek novels. The only way I could judge as to whether or not those things are considered major works by the author, I suppose, is to ask the author.
Yeah.
You know, and some authors I know will tell you, no, please don't read those. That's just to, you know, make money. Or in some cases, authors will frankly tell you that, you know, I can now advertise myself as a New York Times best-selling author for the rest of my life.
Sure.
Because of a Star Wars novel I did. So there are lots of reasons for doing it. And some writers find them not very difficult to write, actually.
Yeah. I'd be very curious to know what Sean Stewart would say about the three books he's done, Kathy's book, Kathy's Key, and Kathy's Ring, which are that kind of interactive thing as well, where they have a phone number and you can call and interact, I think. But they're still middle grade. I mean, this is one of the reasons we wouldn't have covered them particularly. We don't really cover much middle grade fiction. It's more young adult and up.
Right.
And these are really middle grade books. But I'd be curious to know how he feels about them, what he thinks about them. I mean, I maintain he's one of our unfortunately, sadly, tragically lost great novelists to the field. since he's moved on to other things which are, he finds more rewarding. And I mean, I understand why he does it, and I respect it completely. But from a entirely selfish point of view, I would be much happier if he were to actually write the kind of books I want him to write.
And, you know, yeah, his fiction was getting better. Yeah, his fiction was getting better and better and better.
Yes.
But yeah, I agree. I don't know. I don't think we as readers or critics have a right to give career advice to writers.
Oh, Lord,
sometimes
no.
we inadvertently do that, I'm sure.
Well, there's that thing. I think we can argue with it, you know what I mean? And I think we do. I don't know that we're entitled to argue it. I think there's no reason at all that the writer should actually listen to us for even a fraction of a second. But there is that thing where you sit there and go, you know what, I'm going to argue with it just because I want to, and I can argue with it for no other reason, for nothing more than as a fan. You know, I'm a fan of Sean Stewart's books. I loved Perfect Circle. I loved Mockingbird. I loved Galveston. Mm-hmm. I want another one, and I know I'm not going to get one, and that disappoints me. You know, and I think that's fair enough. I don't think it's fair enough for the reviews editor of Locus or a senior critic and reviewer for Locus to be concerned about that. But as a reader privately, I think it's perfectly fine.
Well, to be honest, as a reviewer, that would be a bias. I mean, I would go, this is being brutally honest about myself, I would go into something like that thinking I'm reading this instead of the next Sean Stewart novel after Perfect Circle that I wanted to read. And that would probably bias me against. Now, as I say, different writers have different attitudes to this. Now, Sean may feel that this kind of creative space he's in now is perfectly fine. He's very satisfied with
it. Oh, sure.
I know from other writers, and I probably shouldn't mention it, that they thought this is stuff you do on a weekend to pay your bills for the year so you can write what you really want to write.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are people in between. I mean, Brian Evanson, for example, does not need to write these paperback originals, but he finds it fun as kind of exercising a muscle and learning about the conventions of a field, which he then will take that sort of calisthenic buildup of those muscles back to his own fiction. And he's very conscious of being able to do that.
Yes.
Other writers may think, look, this is fine. Karen Travis, I don't know. I've not talked to her.
No.
But she may think, you know, these Star Wars novels are just fine. I'm happy with them, and I'm going to do them from now on. Or she may be thinking, she may be thinking, this gives me time to spend a lot of time working on a novel, and my next novel under my own aegis, that is my own universe, my own creation, will be easier to sell because I've got the track record now.
Sure, sure.
And one of the things that does happen with writers, unfortunately, they have to look at book scan numbers now.
Yeah.
You write one Star Wars novel and your book scan numbers suddenly are going up, and you look like an author on the rise. The way I've understood from talking to publishers and occasionally to booksellers and occasionally to agents, it's not just your last book on book scan. It's your vector on book scan.
Yes, it is. You
know, if your last book sold more than the one before that, you're on the rise. If you've got two books that sold less than the ones before that, you're on the decline, and that's all they look at.
Well, yes, and I think I suspect also, though I don't know it to be completely true, that if the vector is downwards, then they become more negative. And even if you're doing quite well, I mean, let's say you sold 75,000 copies of book one and 25 or 50,000 copies of book two and 40,000 copies of book three, they're going to be going, maybe we're going to get a lot less than, you know, of book four sort of thing, whatever it might be. Just because of that trend, even though 40,000 sales for somebody else may be spectacularly happy-making. You know, I had a series actually cancelled, right? I had a series cancelled, an anthology series cancelled once, when the sales were at a level that today we would consider to be very, very acceptable for a major publisher here in Australia. But they weren't vectoring up. That was literally all it was. They sort of like, well, you know, they're kind of stable. They didn't go up the way we hoped they would, so we're not going to do it because we only want things that are going up. And you're going, but you know, if somebody came along and sold these numbers, they'd be fine. And you're going, yeah, but we don't want something that's just stable. I mean, obviously, if you're very happily stable, I mean, let's say you're selling 50,000 copies of everything stably, then they're happy. That's money, life's good. But let's say you're at a smaller publishing house or whatever else, and you're selling 3,500 copies. And 3,500 copies breaks even. It makes money, but didn't make a lot of money, you know. The publisher sits there going, well, I want books that are going to make, frankly, a lot of money. And if you're going to sell 3,500, some of them, not all of them, and certainly the bigger houses, they're more likely to do this, will go, that's just not viable for us. We needed to see 3,500 become 5, become 6, become 7, right. not just stably do that. That's the gift of book scan.
Well, and the other problem with book scan and the internal computer ordering systems of Borders and Barnes and Noble and that sort of thing, is that nobody is stable. Nobody is ever stable. That doesn't exist anymore. There's not a reliable writer. In terms of if you sell, let's say you're selling 12,000 copies this year and 10,000 copies last year, that's virtually flat. If you sell 9,000 copies this year and you sold 10,000 copies last year, that's a disaster because that's going to reduce the number of orders you get.
Exactly.
And the number of orders you get is going to reduce the print run, and eventually it just spirals downward.
Well, also, and this is one of those things which I think I saw it discussed online. I think Damian Broderick was discussing it somewhere, and it was driving him crazy, the logic of it, that sort of said, you know, like, if you sold 10,000 one year and 7,000 the next – why would you only do 5,000 the year after? And why do the sales go down? I mean, like, if you print 10,000 and sold 7,000, why can't you just print 7,000 and sell 7,000? That was it. And you kind of go, well, the problem with that is to get those 7,000 sales, you need to be in the kind of number of locations that 10,000 copies gets you to.
Right.
And so these things become progressively self-fulfilling. So, you know, you suddenly print, well, okay, and what's happening though is publishers are printing to the last sales figure quite often. So let's say you've done your 10, 7, 5. Well, now you've sold 5,000 of the previous one, so we're going to print 5,000, but you're not going to sell 5,000, you're going to sell 3.
Exactly. Or another way of looking at it is just percentages. We're talking real shop talk now, but you sell 10,000 and sell, you print 10,000 and sell 7,000, you've sold it 70%. Yeah. So you print 7,000, you can expect to sell 70% of that, and it's just going to go down to zero in about 5 years.
Exactly. And, of course, since we're talking about this being a big year, and that's how it sort of frames, second, the big issue in the background for the year, which was suggested to us by – we asked for some ideas for stuff to discuss on the podcast, and we're not going to get into them very much, unfortunately, because actually we've had a very good conversation already about all sorts of things. But there's two things that came up. One we may get back to, I don't know. But one was e-books. And it's kind of relevant to this that we're talking about right now, just because this was the year where, I mean, everybody's been talking about ebooks being the big coming thing, and they're enormous, they're going to change the universe. And I think in January, everybody wasn't so sure that was the case. I mean, they thought it probably was going to be the case. And then in April, Apple began selling what amounted to, 7 or 8 million iPads, I think. Yeah, of which, according to studies, 79% are used as e-readers. Or e-readers as well. People read books on them, at least. And then the Kindle was reissued and all sort of things. So, you know, the Kindle is impact, or the e-book is now beginning to impact, even though it's still only what they say. For some publishers, it's far more, but generally it's about 3% of the market. But it's one of the big stories of the year, and this possibility that, I mean, I think we touched on it in conversation of some books which are now only in print in e-editions, and that's probably going to be on the rise. And we're going to see
this more. Well, yeah, one of the titles we mentioned, I know the question was what books are only available or what books should become available. And there's a John Wyndham novel, which is one of his big novels of the early 50s, called The Crock and Awakes, as far as I can tell, is only available in a Kindle edition or an ebook edition.
Yeah.
What interests me about that, I've got a friend who's reads and enjoys reading books on her iTouch.
Okay.
I've got a Kindle app for my Droid. You can get Kindle apps for iPhones, iPads, and that sort of thing. I read an article not too long ago, and I think it was some online computing magazine, which was basically saying even the term e-books is almost obsolete already, and they're starting to use the term cloud books.
Yeah,
books that are available in a variety of venues. You read them on your phone. You read them on your iPad. You read them on your Kindle. On the computer, you can actually have a paper copy, but it's the book is distributed in a myriad of different ways, and it's always available. It may not be available in the exact way you want it. And this doesn't even count things like going on websites like ABE or Libris and finding used copies of books, which most people are aware of. If you want to pick up a paperback of a Paul Anderson novel from 1965, chances are you can get it for $1 in a physical book.
Sure. Even though I think you'd agree that doesn't make it really available.
It doesn't make it available in the sense that if everybody decided they wanted the book, they could get it. But when you've got I think that has to be added into the equation, because you have these ABE is one. I forget there's a third one that's actually more interesting than that. If you've got 10,000 used booksellers at one website, then the chances are that most of the books that we're interested in, sort of old science fiction books and fantasy books and that sort of thing, are going to be available in some print form from some book dealer. They are likely to be available in some e-form because there's Google Books, which is just keeps adding and adding and adding things to it.
Yeah.
There are the sort of formalized e-publishing formats, which include Kindle and other things. And so publishing a book means – it doesn't mean one thing or the other. An e-book as a category is only one of many categories the books become available from.
Yes, I think so.
As I understand as I understood the meaning of cloud books, it's a book is out there, you know, like cloud computing in a variety of venues.
Yes. Well, I mean, right now the great barrier for me to the ebook being taken seriously, and we probably touched on it before, and we're repeating ourselves because we do that, is that you have to battle the format wars. You know, I've got two e-readers at the moment for crying out loud, a Sony reader and a Kindle. And I can read on the laptop or the desktop. But there's still that frustration that I can't go to one location and buy all the array of ebooks. I've got to go to this place. You know, maybe it's only available on the Nook. Maybe it's only available on the Kindle. Maybe it's only available on the Sony Reader. And then on top of that, maybe it's not available to me because I live in Australia. Maybe it's not available to me because I live in the UK. All that stuff will but has to be overcome for it to really take off. And I've been dealing with a few people who I know who are really very, very firm advocates of the ebook and get very angry when anything's not available in ebook. And part of me still sits there and kind of goes, you know what? I like it. And one of the great delights for me in the last 6 months is getting Asimov science fiction onto my Kindle because I don't want them kicking around the house. And it's actually really, really, really well done on the Kindle. It's one of the things I'd absolutely take my hat off to.
But, you mentioned that. Asimov's is a good example because one of the reasons I stopped subscribing to the magazines was literally I didn't know what to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
They're not things I wanted to keep forever. And you subscribe to any magazine, at the end of the year, you've got essentially 10 more books to take care of. And it seems to me that kind of a format is almost ideal for a magazine. But for people who absolutely my question for somebody who absolutely believes that they've converted over to the ebook format is, if you really believe in ebooks, are you going to get rid of all the books in your house and replace them?
Aha, that's a great test because to me, I'm old and gray now. I made the transition from LP record to CD, and people can have compared this move from print book to ebook to that, right? Uh-huh. And I got rid of all my vinyl. I mean, I used to have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of LPs. I think I've got one old box that I never play somewhere, about 30 or 40 LPs still. However, and I've got now thousands of CDs or something. However, seriously, when it comes to ebooks, if you said to me, you just downloaded because you couldn't be bothered looking for it, a chapter advance of Nicola Griffith's Nebula Award-winning Slow River, are you willing to get rid of the hardcover first edition you have in the other room?
Uh-huh.
My answer would be no. I love that. And I've been exhorting, and I think it's going to happen, it's in some iteration, I've been exhorting my friend Bill Schaefer at Subterranean Press to put some of his books out in ebook format, and it may happen. And if he did the collected stories of Robert Silverberg, which I'm buying, in ebook format, I'd probably want to have them for various reasons. But I have to tell you, I have these really nice red cloth-bound books, a couple of which Bob was very generous to give me himself, and I value them very highly, and you can all back off. I want to keep them.
Yeah. You know?
I want the nice books.
Exactly. And I'm guessing that most people, even if they like to read things on ebooks, I can visualize a world in which somebody like myself is happily sitting here with an even higher tech, an iPad with a Kindle app or a Kindle or a Sony Reader and that sort of thing, reading a book while I'm looking at the physical copy of the book across the room, thinking, gee, that's a nice book.
Well, I mean, I guess the reason, I argued with a publisher about this. This is why I'd sort of like publishers to sell you a package that was the print book and the ebook at a bit more than the cost of the print book. Because sometimes I want to read the ebook because it's convenient, and sometimes I want to read the print book.
Yeah, and I, for that matter, with the kind of ARFID chips that they you could easily embed an ebook into a bound volume without having to put a CD in it now.
Yeah, probably.
There are all kinds of ways of doing that, but it's a great idea, because I think that ebooks is a mode of reading, but it's not the same mode of reading you get when you look at a bookshelf and say, I think that's interesting, and you pick a book and look at the dust jacket, and something that might not have been interesting to you 2 years ago now is. Well, and when you've got nothing but the text to go on, essentially, then I think that impulsive reading goes downhill. The thing that bothers me about ebooks, and it's essentially, and this is my age possibly speaking, the same thing that bothers me about iTunes, is that everything is deliberate. Everything is planned. You have to say, I want this. I'm going to choose that. And the idea, I tell my students this when they're going to the, they're doing all the research on the line now for papers.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the library and find the book that you're looking at and just look at that shelf of books, there's a bunch of stuff there that you never would have thought of.
Yeah,
that's there because the library has put it together because they've got a nice classification system.
Yes,
and you lose that impulsiveness.
You very much do. I mean, this is an old observation, I guess. I mean, it's ever since Amazon.com became a major book retailer in and of itself. You find what you're looking for on Amazon.com. You find what you didn't know what existed in a good what existed in a good bookshop. And I don't know. I mean, I know there's now. I don't follow it. There's, for example, a great plethora of music blogs and people talking to each other. So personal recommendation becomes a very enormous part of things. But it's not in place so much, I don't think, in the same way for books yet or ebooks yet. And I don't know if it ever will be. I don't know that anything will ever compare quite to being able to walk in and go, oh, I didn't. Or in fact, I do this. I've got a very good bookshop. I've talked about it often here before on the podcast, Planet Books. And I will wander in and I will walk out with a book I didn't know I wanted. Now, I will say, I will say, in fairness, one of the joys of having a Kindle is that I can go online and download a two-chapter sampler and decide if I'm actually interested in that book that I saw. So, you know, this week I read the opening two chapters of Keith Richards' autobiography. I read the opening couple of chapters of Jan Martel's Wolf House, a book I would never have been particularly interested in for various reasons. On our mutual friend Guy Kay's recommendation, I'm reading a book I bought from Amazon directly called Filth by Jane Gardam, which I'm enjoying a great deal. So if you ever hear this, Guy, so far, Old Filth. It's Old Filth, which means I think what failed in London, tried Hong Kong, is very interesting, funny, fascinating book. So, I mean, there's an interface, there's a middle ground to be had. I mean, or similarly, just this morning, I was looking at things to recommend for the recommended reading list, and I know there have been a lot of good reviews for The Half-Made World by Felix Gilman. And I do not have a copy of The Half-Made World by Felix Gilman, but I can download the opening couple of chapters and see if it looks interesting enough for me to buy.
Well, yeah, and the culture of ebooks has not evolved. The culture of books, there's a sort of mystique of books, the community of book readers is, well, it's 600 years old. I mean, it's been a lot of time to evolve, and the ebook community is still, and it looks, but I will give you this reaction. I had, for example, I got the advanced reading copy of the double day edition of Joyce's The Silent Land. I just finished reading it a couple of days ago, in what was file format. It was essentially an ebook format.
Yeah.
And I was really glad to have this book because there are, first of all, you flip through the pages and I find, okay, I can just find immediately passages that I remember or passages that I didn't remember, which is harder to do. I mean, until ebooks figure out some way to flip through pages the way I'm flipping through this book right now, it's hard to say. And the other thing that interests me about this, which is, I should talk to you about this separately, there is, in the British edition of this graphic novel, which I'm going to recommend to people, there is a poem as a kind of frontispiece. It's not in the American edition.
You're breaking up.
And can you hear me now?
Yeah, just I don't know if I'm here and I can hear you. I just don't know whether suddenly we hit a bad port for a minute ago, if we wore it out. But we'll continue on. But if it continues to break up, we'll either maybe switch around a little bit, or we. I'm just sorry for this technical stuff in between, but.
You're breaking up a minute.
So, but yes,
We should probably stop. We should probably stop anyway. We can talk about this at the next podcast.
Okay. So no, because you got to remember we chatted a little bit beforehand. So it's been about an hour.
Well, that's true.
Which is a good length. We don't want to go too long.
Okay. Here's the question I'm going to leave for you and other people because I didn't answer this. And maybe that the Doubleday ARC is going to have this later, but the poem, which appears in the British edition, is a Christina Ricci poem, could be read as a spoiler for the novel.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if the editor in the States thought, well, we'll leave that poem out because it potentially gives away the ending of the novel, depending on how cleverly you read it.
I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out.
I've never thought about that before, but it's very interesting in terms of how a book is marketed.
True. Well, since technology seems to be abandoning us, and since we don't really want to stop and start again, what we might do is wind up. We'll leave some great questions unanswered. We haven't got back to the question of Robert Reed.
No, we haven't, though
we need to. I mean, I was stunned, frankly. He wrote for Terry Carr's Universe.
That long ago?
He's been around 25 years. Yeah. So, I mean,
and
25 years, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 novels, a dozen novels, three collections, 25 years, more than 200 short stories published.
And at least one good, massive proprietary concept, which should have made his name the way it made the name of Larry Niven or Bob Shaw.
Yep, absolutely. So there is a real issue to discuss there. Because I think he's a very good writer. So, okay. Well, it's great talking to you. And I'm sorry technology has abandoned
this
at the moment.
Same here, Andrew.
And we'll talk next week.
All right. Talk soon.
Okay, take care.
Goodbye. All right, goodbye.